Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
William Paul Young was born a Canadian and raised among a Stone Age tribe by his missionary parents in the highlands of what was New Guinea. He suffered great loss as a child and young adult, and he's written a book, The Shack. Singer Wynonna Judd said about his book, The Shack, "Reading The Shack during a very difficult transition in my life, this story has blown the door wide open to my soul." Paul Young, welcome.
I am completely honored to be with you.
Thank you. Well, how nice of you, because I know you have been interviewed by people in the statue of Oprah Winfrey.
So. You know, and she is something special, I got to tell you.
So. Yes, I would think so. So a lot of what you tell about in the book are fictional, but you draw from your own life. And I think that's very instructive for the rest of us to see what you learned in the process of writing this book and why you even wrote it. Are you a writer? Were you a writer, Paul?
I've always been a writer as far as I can remember, but not a published author. I never intended to be a published author. It wasn't on my bucket list. But I've always written, you know, and you write things as gifts for friends and family, poetry and songs and short stories, you know, all the normal stuff. And my wife, Kim, kept saying over the course of about 4 years, you know, someday as a gift for our children, and we have six kids,
I want to make sure people caught that. You have six children, Paul.
Yes, and we have, so far, 12 grandbabies who are 10 years old and under. So, you know.
So you had a rather large audience, if I want to use that word, just within your own family.
Absolutely. Plenty enough for a bestseller. So she said, you know, someday write something as a gift for our kids that puts in one place how you think, because you think outside the box. And you know, because of a lot of my own history and the damages growing up in this world that happens, I didn't feel healthy enough to actually tackle that until the year I turned 50. So I write this story to get it done for Christmas as a Christmas present, because that was a year we had pretty much nothing. And it was my Christmas present to the kids. I got it done, made 15 copies at Office Depot, and you know, gave six to the kids. Kim got a copy, and the rest I gave to my friends, and I went back to work. Those 15 copies did everything I ever wanted this book to do. So everything else that's happened as a result of that has been, in my language, God's great sense of humor. And
You went back to work, you say you went back to work. Was that during the time when you were working three jobs?
Yeah. So I wrote a lot of it on the train to my main job. I was doing shipping and receiving and janitorial for a manufacturer's rep warehouse for circuit boards. And
this is in Portland, Oregon?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So I was cleaning toilets and shipping and receiving. I was also a hotel night clerk part-time. I did food processing in a hotline. And when I could, I did web conferencing for companies all during this time.
So you're having this commute, a 40-minute commute.
Yep.
And you think, well, gosh, maybe this is the time I could write that book that Kim wants me to write.
Exactly. I mean,
and maybe it wasn't even a book, maybe a booklet.
Well, not only that, Kim later, by the time it got put into print, she said, you know, when I asked you to do this, I was thinking like 4 to 6 pages, you know, but you didn't tell me. And I didn't start off intending to write an entire book, but I began with just questions, human questions about loss and tragedy, and especially for those of us who've grown up in any kind of a religious frame of reference, with the idea that there is a God and God is good, and yet here we are in the midst of loss. And how do you begin to reconcile those things? And so, you know, I'm writing a story for my kids that is based out of my own history. So in that sense, it's a parable. So I tell people it's a true story. It's just not real, right? Because it's fiction.
Yeah, yeah. There can be a lot of truth in fiction.
A lot of times there's more truth in metaphor in fiction in some senses. And so, you know, the goal was, here is my story inside of something that will keep the attention of my own children. And the questions were real questions, real significant questions that have been a part of my journey my entire life, especially as a religious person.
Well, can we go back to the beginning, I'll say, because I had a friend who has since died of cancer, but when he was faced with cancer, he had a young son, and this friend had grown up in Kenya, and his son in the United States. And so he wrote the story of his childhood in Kenya, and it was so fascinating. I thought, what a gift to his son, who would never, as an adult, know his father.
Sure.
And so I thought of him, too, as you're writing this story that is rather exotic. I mean, you're born in Alberta, you're born in Canada, but then you're whisked off, a year old?
Yep, 10 months.
Yeah, and how did you go to the other side of the world? What took you there?
So my parents were pioneer missionaries for modern evangelical Protestant denomination, and they had a heart to go somewhere where nobody had been before. And so in their 20s, with a year-old baby boy, we went into the highlands of New Guinea. And that's the big island right above Australia that's split kind of in two. The eastern half was an Australian colony at the time, and the western half was Dutch, under Dutch control. So, but most of the country had never even been penetrated by anybody outside their world. And New Guinea is a kind of a unique place on the planet. Within one island, you have over 800 unrelated language groups.
Oh, my.
And our tribe, the one that we went into, was one of the largest ones, Western Dani. And they had 20 to 40,000 members of the tribe spread over about 100 square miles. So when we went in there, nobody could speak the language. And it was my first language. Because at a year old, children have this unbelievable capacity to just absorb the culture and the languages around them. And I did. So by the time I was five, I was the linguist's informant, you know. But it was a very different world from the one that I didn't know was outside of it. And it had great wonder to it and great beauty to it, as well as incredible devastation on the one hand. And it was a very family-structured tribal culture, but it was also spirit worshiping, warring. They practiced adult euthanasia. There was great darkness and light mixed together. And so part of my experience there was incredibly wonderful, but part of it was very, very difficult and continued to be difficult through a good chunk of my life.
I think you also mentioned that they practice ritual occasionally, perhaps.
Ritualistic cannibalism.
Yes.
Yeah. The valley, the first book ever written about it is called Cannibal Valley. And they didn't do it for food, but they did it for part of their ritualism. And so not exactly the safest environment, but, you know, 20-somethings are still not, I don't think they have a good sense of the world quite yet and are willing to take risks, not only their own, but on behalf of their children sometimes that may not have been the wisest.
My guest is William Paul Young, and he has written a novel, The Shack, where tragedy confronts eternity. And this is a bestseller, The Shack, which was a shock to its author. Now, we have you growing up in New Guinea, and at age six, you were sent off to boarding school. And
yeah.
I have heard such tales of boarding schools in England, for example, how strict they were and how inhumane it almost seems to me to the children. What was your experience of boarding school, and where was this school?
The school was on the coast of New Guinea that became Irian Jaya. It's now called West Papua. And it's like you're torn out of one world and dropped into another one that makes absolutely no sense to you. And you have to understand a couple other issues in my life, great sadnesses at this point. I had a very difficult relationship with my father. He didn't have a chip for being a dad. He had been raised in a very dysfunctional world, orphaned when he was 12, logging camp work from 14 to 18, and then had a conversion experience. His sisters took him to a old camp revival, Sawdust Trail meeting, and he had an encounter with Jesus. And then he went straight from there to Bible school, where he meets my mom, who's a registered nurse by this time, and they get married, have me as a child, and we go to New Guinea. So you can see that he didn't have exactly a frame of reference for being a father. He was a good pioneer. He was a hunter-trapper, and to be thrust into the middle of a jungle was more in line with being thrust into the middle of family. And he was an angry young man. So his anger was part of the issue. The second thing was the sexual abuse that began in my life before I was 5 years old at the hands of the tribal people. And then at six, sent to missionary boarding school, where at night the big boys would come and molest the little boys. And so sexual abuse is a soul fracturing event for anybody. And at six, I'm pulled out of the culture, I'm pulled out of the tribe, I lost my color, I lost my sense of belonging, and trying to survive.
Well, now, when you describe your father, you describe him rather sympathetically, and I would not think that that was easy for you. I would think a good deal of time had to pass before you could try to see your dad as a human being, yeah, with his own problems as a kid.
Yeah, great point. And I think we do that generally. As a child, you know, you just take the blame on yourself for any kind of destructive activity that's happening around you. It's got to be your fault. And children just do that. They don't have a capacity to step outside of their situation and look and see it for what it is. So when my dad was angry, it was my fault. And, you know, we had a theological framework that sort of supported it. We had an angry God. So my dad kind of represented that. And I didn't know about his history. And part of beginning to understand who human beings are is to find out what happened to them. And it doesn't justify any of the abusive activity at all. But it does give us a frame of reference to begin to comprehend how even my dad had been horribly broken and thrust into parenting and fatherhood and everything else. And I've lived long enough to know that that kind of ripple effect impacted my life. And I turned around and hurt people, because hurt people hurt people. And so, yes, I have a lot of empathy for him at my age now that I had to work through. And I had to work through my anger stuff and forgiveness stuff, no doubt about it. And that wasn't easy, and it took time, and it took help. I had to have help working through some of that. But at this point in my life, I've come to the place where I know that I have the power to forgive. Nobody can take that away from me. You know, I can't stop what happened to me in my history, but nobody can take away from me the power to forgive. And it's a massive self-freeing capability that every single human being has.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'll be back with my guest, Paul Young, after a break. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest Paul Young's novel, The Shack, has sold over 20 million copies. He is my guest today, talking about his novel that is a metaphor. You mentioned every human being has these problems you're just describing, but even more specifically, I know so many people that had fathers who were, I won't say like yours, but their relationship reminds me of yours. It seems like you just scratch the surface of so many men, and they have stories like yours. I'm hoping that this generation will, I don't know if it'll be the last, but the generation that I have, like I say, friends who's had this kind of relationship with their own father, and I'm hoping the next generation, we will have learned how to be better dads. Because like you were saying, your dad didn't know how. He had no role model.
He absolutely didn't know how. And I'm seeing a change, and it's slow, and it's arduous, and it's incremental, but it's happening. And I'm watching this planet, and I'm watching the kind of human consciousness that's rising up and saying, like, you know what? We want to make different choices, not only for our own lives, but for the lives of our children. So we've got to re-understand or reform our understanding of what it means to be a father, what it means to be a man, what it means to be a parent, what it means to be a friend. And I'm seeing that start to happen more and more.
Well, I think the fact that you are being open about your own story is going to help these people like my friends, that they don't just tell this. It comes out slowly, and I think people think they're probably the only ones, and when they're not. And I think hearing your story can help a lot of men to take a look at their own lives and their own relationship to their own father.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful thing. And it's a byproduct of the journeys that we make ourselves. And I think, again, those of us who come from my sort of religious family, we were sort of taught to just hide everything, to hide our weakness, to hide our shame. And that's not helpful. I think we're created in the image of a God who's never been alone. And so aloneness itself is the antithesis of authenticity, that we've got to move toward relationship, which is messy, and we're vulnerable, and it has loss embedded into it. And yet, you know, almost all our damage comes from relational devastation of one sort or another. And it's not surprising that our healing is also going to come through relationships. And that's part of the call that's happening, is to come out of secrets, come out of hiding, come out of covering up, and learn how to be an authentic human being, vulnerable, open, uncovered in that sense.
In fact, I wrote down this sentence from your book, verbatim. Since most of our hurts come through relationships, so will our healing.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's absolutely true. You know, it's the relational realities that are around us that love us as we are and love us toward wholeness. And you can't do that in isolation. And yet, you know, you think about what shame does, or what bitterness does, or what unforgiveness does, or lies. All of these things isolate. The addiction, which is linked to shame, of course. But everything that moves you away from relationship and into isolation is destructive. And that's not solitariness and aloneness that's mindful and all that. That's great. But in terms of who we are, as human beings, we need the community of humanity. We need God with skin on to come around our lives and begin to speak the truth to us, even when we don't know what it is.
My guest is William Paul Young. He's written a novel, The Shack. And in this book, the book is a metaphor, but it's based on elements from your own life. And you mentioned community just now, and you were yanked from one community to another. That's the word I want to use, because, well, for one thing, you don't remember Canada, I'm sure, if you're only a year old, but you are in this totally a Stone Age culture in New Guinea. And then at age 6, you're sent off to boarding school. And then when your father comes back to North America, you attended 13 different schools.
Before I graduated high school, yeah, I know. So every hello was a goodbye waiting to happen, right?
Because your father was a pastor, and he was in Western Canada.
An itinerant pastor, yep. So what you do when you are a survivor is you manage the world around you as best you know how. And when you're always moving, then it just reinforces your isolation. Why let anybody in? Not that you ever want to, because, and that's the metaphor of the shack. It's the house on the inside that people help you build. And that's where I stored my addictions. That's where I stored my secrets. That's where I stored my shame. And it was held together by lies. And it was my own broken heart. And so I didn't want anybody in there. I was terrified that if I let another human being into that place, that I would see on their face the look of disgust that I saw in the mirror. And that's the power of shame, which I think is one of the most pervasive, destructive motivators on the planet. And that's why isolation just wraps you into a cycle where you're stuck inside that place. So what I did instead, as I built a facade, you know, it's the quarter-inch piece of plywood that you can paint as fast as you can pick up people's expectations. And you survive by trying to live from the outside in because you don't think anything on the inside is worth anything. And that's what I did. I managed my world as best that I could. And frankly, moving from place to place to place was almost advantageous in the sense that my systems would start to fall apart as people got closer to me. And it was great to be able to just leave before it all fell apart. And I'd start over. But it wasn't long before it would start to fall apart again. You know, those of us who are broken, self-discipline is not an option for a way to come to wholeness. It just doesn't work. It's exhausting. And we just don't have the capacity to follow through with it.
I did know a woman, I started to say young woman, but she was almost middle-aged by the time she told her family that she had been sexually abused as a child. And I knew her well enough to know that it seemed like this facade you were talking about, it seemed to be there. And I had no clue why I had that feeling. But she went to counseling for bulimia. And after the counseling, she was like a different person. She was so honest and open. She was the person that I all along felt she could be, but she held back and she held this secret for years.
Yeah, we're trapped by our secrets. You know, on the one hand, I can't tell you my secrets because I'm terrified of your response. But when you offer me the very things that keep me alive as a human being, kindness, grace, affection, affirmation, encouragement, underneath that, I don't believe you. I don't believe, because you don't know my secrets. If you knew my secrets, you wouldn't be offering me these things. So I'm utterly trapped by secrets. And part of the journey out is to find someone that you can begin to trust, that you can then unload and share your secrets with so that you can move in the direction of learning how to be an authentic human being. But secrets are devastating.
Well, now you didn't have a good relationship with your father, and yet you did follow somewhat in his footsteps. You went to Bible college, and thought it was interesting the way you paid your way through Bible college.
I was a rock and roll disc jockey for CKCK Radio in Saskatchewan. And I know, kind of an oxymoron, but I'm a missionary kid, so we kind of get away with stuff sometimes that others can't, to a degree. But and I didn't study theology in order to become a professional Christian. I wasn't really interested in that. I was really pursuing understanding who God was. And I didn't know any other track to try to pursue that except through the study of scripture and theology and doctrine and all that kind of stuff. And there were some great things that I got out of that, some skill sets that I got out of that. But it didn't heal anything in my heart, you know, because you can do one thing in your head while the rest of you is absolutely shattered. You can learn to disassociate your intellect away from your heart and then try to live out of your intellect. I know a lot of my friends who've done that in their lives, especially the men that I know well. And it's like everything below the neck is broken. And so they try to find some kind of solace or some kind of of an ivory tower in their intellect in order to protect themselves or stay safe or build an identity, a worth, sense of worth. And that's a house of cards. It's just a matter of time before the issues of the heart are going to erupt in a way that there's no way you can protect yourself through just intellectuality. We're designed to be whole people, not just you know, what does C.S. Lewis call it? He says, men with empty chests, with no chests, men with no chests. That is, they have heads and intellect, but their hearts are just absent. And we're not designed to be that way.
Well, when I learned that at one time you were part of a drama troupe, I thought, well, that's good preparation for being in the pulpit and being a pastor. But it sounds like that was not what you really envisioned as your life's work.
Not at all. And I didn't know what my life's work was. And so it was more like relating to whatever came along my way. So I got involved in business and other kinds of ventures along
the way.
And yet
your undergraduate degree was in religion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I graduated Phi Beta Kappa Summa Cum Laude, and I walked out thinking I fooled everybody. Mm. That's the power of shame. And
And you went to seminary.
Yes. And I went to seminary.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. Again, pursuing the questions, real questions. And that's the questions that show up in the context of the shack. Those are real questions. And that's part of the reason the book has had the kind of impact that it's had, is that it has given people a language to have a conversation about God that is not religious, but is relational.
In fact, the back cover of your book says, The Shack wrestles with the timeless question, where is God in a world so filled with unspeakable pain?
Yep.
And so many people wonder that very question, Paul.
Yeah. And it's a very human and a right question. It's a good question. And I grew up in a world where you weren't allowed to ask that question. And it's over the course of a lifetime, over a course of lots of losses, because we live in a world that if we have anything in common, it's that we've experienced loss and love. You know, that's more cohesive in our experience than politics or economics or religion or anything else. And that question is a significant one. Like, if God is good, as my evangelical family believes, and is powerful, then why? Where was God when the sexual abuse was happening in my life? Where was God when my father showed up without a capacity? You know, why was I born into that situation? You know, and everybody's got their own version of that, of those kinds of losses. And that's what I'm trying to wrestle with within the context of the book. And of course, you know, nobody's going to come up with all the answers. But a lot of times these kinds of questions are framed outside of the context of relationship. And I don't think you're ever going to come anywhere close to an answer that fills the human heart if you try to come up with it outside of relationship. And that's also then who is God? What is the character and nature of God? Who am I as a human being? And part of the answer to the question about human pain and suffering and tragedy, I think we have a low view of what it means to be human to begin with. That we don't realize what a magnificent creation we are. We don't realize our capacity and power to make choices that then ripple into the cosmos and have true impact. And I think that, because I believe in a God, and I believe in the God of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, but that means to me that relationship is at the heart of everything. But it also means that this God has an unbelievable comprehension of the beauty and the magnificence of what it means to be human, and that God will not violate that, even for our own good, you know, because forced love is no love at all. And so part of the question is, who are we as human beings? Why do we participate in such destructive choices? And what is the driver behind that? And what do we want God to do? Just come and get rid of our capacity to make bad choices, or to crawl into these bad choices with us and co-create something that is actually living in the context of the destructive darkness that we brought to the table? And I'll go with the latter every time, even though the chaos that we have managed to produce is substantial and far-reaching and devastating. And woven into that is the beauty of humanity, the wonder of what we can create, our ability to celebrate art and dance and music and joy and love and human sexuality and kindness and grace and compassion. And we're just this big mess of the beautiful and the betrayed and the dark and the delicate. You know, it's the wonder of living inside this cosmos and the mess, the beautiful mess of humanity.
My guest is Paul Young, and he is a bestseller. His bestseller, The Shack, has sold over 20 million copies. Is that still up to date, Paul?
Over 23 million
now.
After about 10,000, you lose count.
Yeah, who's counting? Well, you described, from what you described as your father and growing up, you were unlucky there. You know, why were you born into that situation? But it seems to me
I was born into that situation because my mom and dad had sex, right?
And yes.
And here's a good thing. We as human beings have the capacity to together create another human being who will never cease to exist, from my point of view. That is creativity that makes any book or movie or song look infinitesimally small. And yet so much damage is done to the children around the world. And that's because we don't know who we are. So, yeah, my parents made choices, and God submitted to those choices. Like, all right. And that comes with their genetics, the family history, and everything else that is a part of what they brought to the table.
Well, I was saying that you were unlucky, perhaps, with your relationship to your dad, but you married a woman, and from what I know about the situation, you were very lucky, Paul, in marrying a young woman, Kim Warren.
Yeah, blessed beyond repair. And Kim is from a very different world than me. She and her family migrated from North Dakota, Minnesota. You know,
you're speaking their language.
Yeah, yep. And Wes, Kim's got a big family, 5 sisters and 2 brothers. And, you know, North Dakota, there's no 50 shades of nothing. It's either this or that.
So having 6 children is rather normal for you and Kim.
Well, my family was 4. Kim's family was much larger. My family still is very small. I have a niece and a nephew. But if you count Kim and all of her relatives and everything down to the grandkids, there's about 150 now.
We mentioned the fact that here you are, an author, supposedly, but you didn't have any, you did have some experience writing before you wrote The Shack, but it was, I think, technical writing. It was not creative writing.
Some was creative. I did poetry and songs and short stories. You know, you write stuff and you give them to your family and you give them to your friends just as a way of saying, I see you or I love you or I appreciate you. So that part of the creative side was there, but I never took classes. I didn't study it. I didn't major in any of it. I learned to write by reading books. And I think a lot of us in my generation did that. Because we had so many good writers to read. And that's how I learned to write, was through reading. But writing was the only way to get the inside world out.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. My guest, Paul Young, will be in Chico on April 21st for the 3rd annual Spring Luncheon for the Jesus Center. We'll be back after a break. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with Paul Young to continue our conversation about his best-selling novel, The Shack. Your relationship to Kim hit a rough spot in the road. I'm not sure how old you were then.
38. January 4th, 1994.
Oh, my goodness.
About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, yeah.
Oh, you remember it well.
Oh, I remember it absolutely clearly. And and it's, you know, here's the thing. You keep a life of secrets. You keep a life of addictions. You hide it all and try through self-discipline or through whatever else to find a way out. And you're hoping you can get to a place of wholeness without anybody else finding out about it. And yet the necessity of human participation in all of our struggles is absolutely essential. So at one point, at 38 years old, Matthew, our sixth child, had just been born. And I broke the world. That is, I got exposed. And exposure is a terrifying mercy, but absolutely necessary if we're going to come to healing. And so I got a one-sentence phone call from Kim on January 4th, 94. And all she said was, I'm waiting for you at your office, and I know. And what she knew was I was in a three-month affair with one of her best friends. And at that point, there was no place to run, no place to hide.
And you knew what she meant. She didn't even have to finish that sentence. She just said, no. I know. And you knew instantly.
I knew. And I had to make a choice whether to face her or kill myself. You know, a lot of us who come from the brokenness of that kind of history, suicide becomes, it's a crazy way to put it, but it becomes your point of hope. That is, it is the last way to run away before you have to actually face your stuff. And I had to make a choice at that point was either face Kim and all of my shame and all of my devastation or kill myself. And I to this day, I don't know how I made it across town. And I walk in and she's already taken the place apart, you know, physically. And she is not a meek, mild, submitted woman, let me tell you. And her five sisters are called the Force, and may the Force be with you. And
so she physically dismantled your office?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And lights into me, and about 4 hours into it, I say to her, okay, if we're going to do this, I need to tell you every secret that I have, because secrets have been killing me my whole life. And naively, she said, bring it on. And it took me the better part of 4 days to tell her everything she didn't know. And she wanted to know details about everything, and I told her. And 4 days later, I mean, she was destroyed. And it was like, all right, what do we do? So I pulled the yellow pages off the shelf. I look under counselors, and for the first time in my life, I walk into an office of total strangers and say, can someone help me? And it wasn't to fix the marriage. I'd blown that up. It wasn't to fix Kim. I mean, I couldn't even heal myself. Why would I have the audacity to think I could heal anybody else? And it was to say, look, I need to find a way to change. I need to understand how what happened to me has continued to affect every facet of my life. And that started a journey. I met Scott Mitchell, who became my therapist and then later my friend. And that started an 11-year dismantling process and a rebuilding process that is represented by the weekend Mackenzie spends in the shack. And at the end of those 11 years, you know, 13 years down the road, after this cataclysmic exposure, Kim and I are completely reconciled, you know. But it took 11 years for Kim and I to heal. And to the place where she trusts me implicitly, and she has every reason to. But man, I never thought that would ever happen. I thought she would never believe another word that came out of my mouth the rest of my life. That's what she said that day that I was exposed.
My guest is Paul Young, and he is going to be in Chico at a fundraiser for the Jesus Center. He'll be the featured speaker. His novel, The Shack, is really a metaphor. And in real life, it was an 11-year process. You were just telling us this journey took 11 years. In the novel, it happens on a weekend to the main character. Mm-hmm. And you say in your book, the journey to get to where you have no secrets is embarrassing and devastating. You have to learn to trust. And it sounds like Kim practiced that, because you say she did. You thought she could never trust you again, and yet she has learned to do that.
Forgiveness is an unbelievably powerful part of our humanity, if we will exercise it. And she forgave within those 11 years, but reconciliation is a very different thing than forgiveness. And reconciliation is the rebuilding of trust. And if that happens, it's miraculous. And I, as the perpetrator of this loss, I had no rights to put a timetable or an expectation on reconciliation. And when it happened, it was miraculous. I mean, I couldn't even explain to you how, but it was incremental, day by day, living inside the grace of just one day, putting one foot in front of the other, doing the work, and here we are, the best we've ever been, and obviously better than we could have ever been without my exposure. But that doesn't justify anything. You know, it doesn't justify adultery or a betrayal of any sense. There is no justification for that. But it's part of the arduous work that we can do.
Well, you say that part of being human is learning to speak the language of loss. Loss is something we all have in common. And what you've just said, though, that you, when you told Kim, you admitted she found out about your adultery, that it appeared at the time that you were going to lose her, maybe your own life, but yet you didn't. So when you talk about loss in your own life, what kind of loss do you mean?
Boy.
Since it wasn't your marriage.
Well, it was my marriage. I lost that. And so what we have now doesn't even look like what we had, right? I blew that up. Adultery blows up any semblance of what you had in terms of what a marriage is and supposed to be. And so, I lost that. I lost the sense of community that I had built. You drop a bomb like betrayal in the middle of a network of relationships, and the ripple effect of that is just profoundly devastating in the lives of other people. I still am not fully reconciled to people who I hurt 20-some years ago inside this sequence of events, and who knows how that will work itself out. But lots of loss. You know, and not only, I mean, we can talk about this particular story and the losses there, but we live in a world full of losses. You know, we had a 6-month period where my 18-year-old brother was killed. Kim's mom had a massive coronary and died unexpectedly. And 3 months later, my 5-year-old niece was killed the day after her 5th birthday. So loss is something that, so, you know, most of the people listening to you will have been touched by cancer in one sense or another. Someone immediate or someone they know or cared for has been impacted by that, and definitely by accidents and financial loss and all kinds of things. So we share that in common.
In fact, you say that loss is our story, and that if we haven't been touched by loss yet, it's just a matter of time.
Yeah. You know, Brené Brown has this fantastic couplet. She says, if you don't own your own story, it will own you. But if you own your own story, you have the authority to write the ending. And that's part of the journey toward wholeness, is that you got to turn your face into the wind and own your own story. And once you own your own story, you have the right to write the ending. Otherwise, it'll own you. And that's the journey that so many of us are on, toward authenticity, toward becoming the people that we always were but didn't know, kind and gentle and pure of heart and furious at injustice and faithful, and all of those things that I think were made in the image of God and are true about us before we were ever damaged.
Earlier, I mentioned that I have so many friends, male friends, who had unfortunate relationships with their own fathers, and I thought it was amusing that you explored this question. If men are obviously more screwed up than women, how come they're in charge?
That comes from my religious frame of reference as a modern evangelical fundamentalist, because in my life, most of the damage had come from men. And yet it was the men that were on the pedestals. It was the men who had the positions of power. And I looked around the world and I thought, look, most of the damage in the world comes from men. It's not that women can't be beastly, because they can. But generally speaking, it's not the women who run away from their children. It's not the women who vacate and leave. It's not the women who start wars. There are no brothels built for women. It's men who traffic in human souls. It's we who create the institutions of power in order to maintain control. It's we who are focused on territory and people as possession and property. And it's like, okay, we're really, really messed up, and yet we're supposed to be in charge. So that was kind of an accusation against my own tradition, who was so hierarchical and gender-centered in terms of the masculine positions of power and dominance. And I've worked on that question within my own frame of reference for 40-some years. That's why I wrote the book Eve, is to try to answer that
question.
That's
your third novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was The Shack and then Crossroads and Eve. And Eve is the one that I wrote to try to deal with the questions that we just are talking about. Because Scripture itself says that it was through a man, not through the woman, that the brokenness of the cosmos entered. And through that brokenness entered death. And then, you know, the juxtaposition in Scripture is that Jesus, as a man, then comes to redeem not just all of our humanity, but also specifically the male side of the conversation, so that we can all come to wholeness and that we can all begin to understand what it means to be fully human and fully alive. So that's what couched that question.
Well, in our imaginations, in yours, in the character in your book, God is this older figure with a long white beard. He is male. He's an old white guy.
Not my book.
that's why it's, your main character, why does he go to the shack to begin with, where he meets this God like none of us expected?
I know. See, you have to remember, I wrote this for my kids. I didn't think the whole world was going to read it. So I grew up with Gandalf with a bad attitude God, that distant white, the darkness behind Jesus, you know, that needed a sacrifice, needed to be appeased, was the ultimate judge. And Zeus, basically. And I wrote the book partly because I don't want my kids growing up thinking that that's who God is, because that's not the God who showed up and healed my heart. But I wanted a better metaphor, a better image, imagery for God. So when Papa comes through the door, it's not Gandalf with a bad attitude. It's not Zeus. It's a large black African-American woman. Traditional theology espouses that God is neither male nor female, or that all maleness and all femaleness originate in the very being of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And so the image of God is male-female. And yet we have such skewed the conversation to the male side that we're surprised or even offended by the idea that the imagery for God could be feminine, even though it's all over Scripture. In Isaiah, God is a nursing mother, a woman who's pregnant. In the New Testament, a woman who loses a coin. There is a name of God being the breasted one, the nourishing one. The word mercy comes from the same root as the word womb. And so when you deal with the mercy of God, you're dealing with womb love. And on and on and on. Just to say that you cannot use imagery to define God. It's a window through which you see some aspect of the nature and character of God. And I, all I did was played with it. And who knew that that imagery would become so powerful in the conversation that is rising up on the planet? Because frankly, men have done such damage that God presented in simply masculine terms is not helpful for so many of us. And we have to still deal with it. And in both the book and the movie, God does manifest near the end in masculine form, because we still need to deal with that imagery as well, not just eradicate it or obliterate it. It's part of the conversation, but for many of us, we've lost the maternal presentation of God, and it's been incredibly disruptive, and it's a huge loss within the family of humanity conversation.
Well, the loss in the book happens to be a father loses his young daughter, and the metaphor, that's a metaphor of the loss, I think, that you and the child within you.
That's exactly loss. Yeah.
Well, we're looking forward to your coming to Chico, and you'll be the featured speaker for the third annual Spring Luncheon of the Jesus Center. That'll be on Saturday, April 21st, held at the Lakeside Pavilion at California Park in Chico. And proceeds will benefit vocational training programs at the Jesus Center. So it's been a pleasure talking to you, Paul. And I might remember.
I'm so honored. I am. I love National Public Radio. I love what you folks do. And I'm honored to be on this with you. So thank you.
The pleasure is ours. Thank you, Paul. My guest has been Paul Young. His novel is The Shack. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.